Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're Monday, April 4th, and we're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 71. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 71.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 71 makes recipients of general educational development certificates eligible for general polygraph licenses.
All right, and we have one individual that's going to give us testimony today. Marilyn, why don't you come on up? And while she's getting situated, was there anyone else who would want to give testimony on Senate Bill 71? Marilyn, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Prusansky and members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. One of my program's responsibilities, in addition to the ones that you may be more familiar with, is to manage the polygraph licensing program for the state of Oregon. Our agency has received several inquiries in recent years from people interested in becoming licensed as a general polygraph examiner. However, they have obtained a GED rather than graduating from high school. The statutory educational requirements in the Polygraph Examiners Act are very specific. The person must either have a bachelor's degree or have a high school diploma. The language says they need to be a graduate of an accredited high school and have 5 years of investigative experience. When we checked with our Department of Justice counsel, they advised us that the language of the statute is so specific that in order to allow a general education development equivalency, we would need to seek a statutory change. And we simply don't want to disqualify otherwise qualified applicants because they have gotten a GED instead of a high school diploma. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone? Pretty straightforward, basically going to make it equitable for those who just get the GED and
yes.
Be able to do with those who have a high school diploma. All right, with that, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony in Senate Bill 71? We'll go ahead and close the public hearing. I believe we cannot move the bill today because we're waiting for fiscals. This was set on as at the request of the agency, so we need to get that and then we'll bring it back. So it will be get scheduled for a work session. We will have it posted before the end of the week, so it will make the deadlines that we need to have. With that, I'm going to go ahead and we're going to go ahead and open up public hearings on all of the other bills that are before us. What we're going to do is we'll bring panels up. I'll be alternating between proponents, opponents, proponents. And Mary Williams, I know that you're here to give testimony. You came in late. I'm not sure. I'm assuming on the opposition side or neutral?
Neutral to opposition on some part.
Okay. So what we're going to do is I'm going to open up a public hearing, like I said, on all of these bills. So if you're... It looks like many of the individuals that are signed up for each one. If you have specific information you want to give us about a specific bill, please designate that this testimony that you're giving on that point is for that particular bill. That way we won't be running everyone back up and forth for five or six different times. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearings on Senate Bill 355, 365, 366, 367, 368, 369 and 370. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, all these bills come from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senate Bill 335 is the amendments replace the bill, and 355 for those found guilty of aggravated murder eliminates a sentence of life with the possibility of parole. And considering whether to impose a death penalty eliminates from jury consideration future dangerousness of the defendant, requires a district attorney in an aggravated murder case to file notice of intent to seek the death penalty no later than 180 days after the defendant is charged with aggravated murder, does not allow a defendant to enter a plea not guilty to a charge of aggravated murder more than 90 days before trial without DA consent. Chair members of the committee, Senate Bill 365 requires the Attorney General to drop rules that describe the circumstances under which the state may seek the death penalty. 366 requires the county where the defendant is charged with the aggravated murder to pay one half the aggravated murder litigation costs incurred by the Judicial Department, the Department of Justice, and the Public Defense Services Commission. 368, the court may not sentence the defendant to death unless a district attorney filed with the court notice no later than 180 days after the defendant is charged with aggravated murder, the death penalty is being sought. Prohibits the court from accepting this notice no less than 90 days before trial. Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Senate Bill 367 creates a death penalty review committee consisting of the Attorney General, former district attorney, or assistant district attorney, one defense attorney, two retired judges. Mr. Chairman of the Committee, 369 creates a death penalty review panel, directs the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court to appoint three retired judges with experience in death penalty cases. 370 requires the Oregon Supreme Court in conducting automatic review of death sentence to review whether there is sufficient evidence to justify the imposition of a sentence of death. 2, considering the nature of the crime and the characteristics of the defendant, the sentence is excessive as compared to similar cases. The sentence was brought about through passion or prejudice, and finally, the defendant is mentally retarded. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this from last session and the interim before, and we had testimony concerning a comparison between Washington State and Oregon as it relates to the number of death penalty cases and number of people in death row.
All right, thank you. One other announcement before we get started with our public hearing. We did have scheduled for today a work session on Senate Bill 450. We will not be moving the bill today. One of the individuals that needed to be here for potential questions is not able to be here today, but my understanding will be here on Thursday. So we will be setting Senate Bill 450 for this coming Thursday, which is, I believe, the 7th, and we will have it posted as required. With that, let's go ahead and call up our first panel, and I have Barnes Ellis and Catherine Allward. And whoever would like to get started, we need your name for the record, and then please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barnes Ellis. For the past 10 years, it's been my privilege to be chair of the Public Defense Services Commission. That commission was created by a 2001 bill from this committee, and Mr. Taylor here was instrumental in drafting it. We hope we have lived up to his and the committee's expectations.
We all do. The elder of our group.
PDSC is responsible for provision of competent defense counsel in all criminal cases involving indigents. Defense costs in virtually 100% of aggravated murder cases are our responsibility and are funded by taxpayer dollars, because no one can afford to pay the cost of these cases privately. As a rule of thumb, we incur about $1 million a month on these cases, or $24 million per biennium. To paraphrase the late Senator Everett Dirksen, pretty soon we're talking real money. I and the others you will hear from PDSC and the Office of Public Defense Services are here not as advocates for or against any particular of the bills that you're considering, but rather as information resources. In the past few years, our commission has held three hearings regarding capital cases. We took testimony from a number of highly qualified persons who were expert in the field. I will ask OPDS staff to provide you with the transcripts from those hearings, which I think you will find extremely interesting. Knowledgeable persons we heard from included Professor Bill Long from Willamette, whose book on capital punishment in Oregon I commend to you for its detailed history of the issue. Judges Michael McShane of Multnomah County and Richard Barron of Coos Curry, both of whom have presided over a large number of these cases. Tim Sylvester of the Oregon Department of Justice, who is responsible for the state's role in these cases, both in appellate and post-conviction. Three of our state's best capital defense lawyers, Dwayne McCabe, Rich Wolf, and Dennis Balski. Professor and former capital defense lawyer Sean O'Brien and Robin Mayer of the American Bar Association's Capital Representation Project. and the two individuals who have served PDSC as our capital resource attorney, Matt Rubenstein and Jeff Ellis, who's of no relationship, and you're going to hear from him a little bit later. So while I do not claim to be an expert on these issues, our commission has heard significant testimony from persons who properly can be described as expert. In a few moments, I will discuss some startling statistics contrasting our experience in Oregon with that of Washington, which Mr. Taylor has already referenced. But let me first summarize what our commission has been doing in this area. Under our enabling legislation, we are charged with two standards. We are to provide defense services that meet national standards of quality, and we are to provide those services in as cost-efficient a manner as possible. There is an obvious tension between those two, and our task is to try to do both. In death penalty cases, we have addressed the quality issue in several ways. First, we have adopted the ABA standards for these cases, which, among other things, require that each case be staffed with two experienced and qualified attorneys, and that a qualified investigator and a qualified mitigation specialist be assigned, in addition to mental health and forensic experts. Second, we have established a capital resource attorney as an FTE of OPDS to assist defense trial teams all around the state, appellate teams on direct appeal, and post-conviction attorneys in the post-conviction phase. We did this to avoid reinventing the wheel in an area that is among the most complex areas in the law and where mistakes can be very costly both to the defendant and to the system. Third, we have moved to a contract system for providers, which has allowed our average compensation in this field to be about $90 an hour versus $60 for court-appointed, which is right at the national median for this work. Fourth, we have worked to attract and to contract with more mitigation specialists to be available to Oregon attorneys. And finally, we have contracted with competent lawyers to work in the post-conviction process, which, as I will explain, is an essential part of these cases. We believe that all of these quality measures are necessary and mandated by our statute. And we also believe that in this area, quality is itself a big cost saver. Any of you who has followed the Guzik case in Deschutes County knows how expensive retrials can be. But is there anything that can be done to reduce the enormous cost to the taxpayers? Before addressing that, let me say that I am not here to debate whether capital punishment is a good or a bad idea, or to criticize the work of the district attorneys or the Department of Justice in Oregon. Our commission has had an excellent relationship generally with the prosecution bar, most notably in 2003, the infamous year of the five special sessions, each cutting more of our budget than the last, when several prosecutors came to Salem to testify in favor of restoring the defense services budget because they realized that in our criminal justice system, each part is interdependent on each other part. So it is in that spirit that I make several observations. First, for a lot of good reasons, some obvious and some less obvious, any case that carries the risk of capital punishment is considerably more expensive to process than murder cases not charged as aggravated. So long as the risk of a death penalty is there, the defense has no choice but to prepare on the assumption the state will seek the death penalty. So the two-lawyer investigator and mitigation specialist team is essential. Second, the state post-conviction costs are substantial, and almost all of these cases will incur those costs. There are at least four reasons for this. One, in the 1980s, the U.S. Supreme Court and later Congress took the position that the federal courts could not consider in their post-conviction process any issue that was not raised and developed in the state proceedings. So the stakes in the state PCR process are quite high, because if not properly handled, the defendant loses not only his or her state, but also his or her federal PCR rights. Two, these proceedings tend to be very protracted. That is in part because there's obviously little incentive for the defense to move them along, and because they're usually factually very involved, the state AG's office, with its limited resources, cannot process them very rapidly. And with the defendant incarcerated throughout, there may be a tendency to think of these cases as the equivalent of life without parole, and some question whether the Oregon public really wants a rash of actual involuntary executions. Three, with the dispersal of Oregon high-security prisons, many of these cases now are venued in Umatilla County, not Marion County, and it is difficult to obtain quality lawyers to do these cases, which require substantial contact with the client in the more remote areas of the state. And there are other costs that do not hit our budget, but the taxpayers pay for them, such as jury selection. To get 50 eligible jurors in these cases requires some 2,000 citizens to be subpoenaed, and special incarceration costs. As I indicated, by far the most startling information we learned from our hearings is the remarkable contrast between Oregon on the one hand and our immediate neighbor to the north, Washington, on the other. Both have the death penalty for aggravated murder. The legal standards are substantially the same. The demographics of the populations are essentially identical. Washington's population is nearly double that of Oregon, so, as we might expect, the number of murders in Washington is about double that number in Oregon. But there, the similarities stop. Oregon has 36 individuals under death sentences compared to Washington's 8, or 9 times what we would expect after adjusting for population. Since 2000, Oregon has imposed death sentences in 20 cases compared to 3 in Washington, or more than 12 times what we would expect after adjusting for population. Oregon has 31 capital cases pending at the trial level compared to 5 in Washington, or 12 times what we would expect after adjusting for population. So why are there these striking differences between the two states? What we were told in our hearings is that the biggest factor driving the Oregon experience versus the Washington experience is that in Oregon, the practice is to charge many murders as aggravated at the outset, but negotiate a plea later, often to true life, with the risk of the death penalty as a significant bargaining chip. But those negotiations tend to take place at or near trial, which often will be 18 months or more after the initial charge, and after much of the major expense of the case has been incurred. In Washington, the decision whether to seek death is by statute, not made until 60 days after indictment, a date that can be extended by consent, when notice of election to seek the death penalty is filed. During the interval between indictment and the notice of election, the defense has a chance to discuss the likely mitigation evidence with the prosecution and the passions at time of arrest have cooled off, with the result that a remarkable number of these cases proceed without the risk of death, and therefore without the additional costs of a capital case. In Oregon, many of these cases, initially charged as capital, plead at a lesser sanction, or the DA later drops the death sanction, but after many of the heavy costs of a death case have been incurred. In Oregon, we actually only have an average of 3 to 5 of these cases tried as capital cases each year, although up to 10 times that number are initially charged as capital cases. And while an average of approximately 27 death-eligible cases are filed in Oregon each year, less than an average of two per year actually receive a death sentence. These strikingly different data from Washington versus Oregon may suggest to you that much of the substantial expense we incur in these cases in Oregon is avoidable while still retaining the death penalty in extreme cases as approved by the voters in 1984. I appreciate your inviting me. Catherine Elward is the director of our Business and Contract Services Department. She can discuss cost issues, and Jeff Ellis, whom I mentioned, our capital resource attorney, is also available. I'd be happy to answer questions now, or you can hear from Ms. Elward.
Mr. Ellis, we'll wait and hear from Catherine, and then we'll open up the panel.
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Catherine Aylward, and as Barnes said, I'm the Director of the Contract and Business Services Division of the Office of Public Defense Services. One of the handouts I provided you just shows you a breakdown in terms of numbers of cases, and this is aggravated murder cases filed since 1984 when the death penalty was reinstated. And I'm only listing the ones with the possibility of death. So if it were a juvenile defendant, there would be no possibility of death. Those are excluded. And any cases in which the incident date was prior to the reinstatement of the death penalty. So there were 795 such cases filed. The first person who looked at this table said, wait a minute, you've buried the lead. Where are all the other cases? Where did all the other cases go? Well, there are 696 of those cases that did not result in a death sentence at their first trial. So 87% of the cases just had some other sentence than death. 26 of the cases were dismissed, 10 were acquitted, and in 63 cases, there was a sentence of death. 63 cases, there happened to be 60 defendants. One defendant had three separate cases, three separate death sentences, in case you wonder how these numbers can add up. So right now we have 31 cases pending at the trial level and 34 cases that are continuing post-trial, either on appeal, post-conviction relief, or an appeal of a post-conviction relief case. There were two people executed, and four cases disappeared because two people died. So that's sort of where we are. If you look down at the bottom of the list, you'll see two are now in the federal system. So as far as public defense expenses go, we watch these cases and pay for them all the way up until they're in the federal system, and then we no longer have costs associated with those. Of course, the AG's office does continue to accrue costs even when cases go in the federal system, and you may hear about that from Mary Williams. But so part of our story that's sometimes difficult to explain is that the cost of death penalty cases, it's not just the cases that are filed and tried this year or this biennium. That's maybe a third of the cost. But what happens is that we continue to have costs from cases in prior biennia. So a case that was filed 2 years ago, maybe now we're paying for the appellate costs on those cases. A case filed 4 years ago, maybe we're paying for post-conviction relief. So what we've seen since 1984 is a continuing ramp up of the expenditures for capital cases altogether. So that's part of what you have to take into consideration. Any action, that any statutory changes that are made now, you will likewise see the savings ramp up over multiple years, unless you're talking about, you know, commuting the existing sentences. We still have anyone who has a death sentence will continue to incur costs as the cases move through the state system. The flip side of this handout just shows a rough breakdown for next biennium, how our expenditures are divided. $197 million of the account goes toward all the other cases we do, the non-death penalty criminal cases, felonies, misdemeanors, civil commitments, civil cases, and a large, large part of what we do is abuse and neglect cases. All of those 345,000 cases, compared to 50 new cases we anticipate being filed next biennium, costing us $27 million. So I look at that and think that perhaps there's a better distribution of our limited resources if there's something we can do, because the need is obviously very great in the other areas of representation. People talk to me about how much a case costs and how much a statutory change will save, and it's tricky. I mean, a case will cost anywhere from tens of thousands to several million. And so when you talk about an average case cost or a typical case cost, it really depends on what you're looking at. Are you looking at the last few years, the last 10 years, since 1984? Are you looking at only those that went to trial, those that pled out? So a real quick shorthand, let's say $200,000, typical cost for a death penalty case at the trial level, not everything that continues on after that. So we tried to look at what would those cases cost if they didn't have a death penalty. So first we said, well, let's compare them to just murder cases. Well, maybe a murder case costs $40,000. So there, haven't you saved $160,000 per case? Well, maybe, but a murder case, the penalty is 300 months. And if we were talking about aggravated murder cases with a penalty of life without parole, that seems more serious to me. So then we tried comparing aggravated murder cases where there couldn't be a death sentence, so the juvenile cases. We looked at the cost of those, and it was about half, so maybe $100,000, $125,000 for the cases where the death penalty was not a possibility. So then you say, well, maybe I'm saving half or, you know, something like that. So we can, I'm happy to come up with all different kinds of figures depending on what specific changes you're looking at. Obviously, the range of savings is somewhere between, you know, zero and 27 million. It's not going to be 27 million because those cases will still be there. They will still be serious cases. But maybe you're looking at a savings of 5 to 10 million if there were no death penalty. And I know that's really rough, but again, all of these things depend on the decisions that are made by district attorneys. You know, even when you say there's a notice provision, well, what decision is a district attorney going to make? I don't know. You're also dependent on the decisions that defendants make. If it's life without parole, are you more likely to go to trial and incur additional costs? I don't know. So, you know, I'm sorry I can't give you something more exact, but I think the neighborhood is really what you need to know in making your decisions, and I think 5 to 10 million, maybe increased savings as time goes on if fewer and fewer cases continue, you know, receive the death penalty and then continue on this more expensive path. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Questions for anyone on the panel? First, Senator Wessett, and then Senator Obeji.
Thank you, Catherine. You sort of touched on this, but I think on the one hand we have some concrete figures, on the other hand it's kind of speculation, but how much of an incentive is there for a guilty defendant to plead guilty to avoid exposure to the death sentence? And can you quantify the potential savings of not proceeding with these trials that have been pled out, as opposed to actually, I mean, the flip side of this is we could have a lot more people actually going to trial if the death sentence wasn't on the board.
Mm-hmm. Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, yes, I did look at that, and the cost of cases that went to trial was about $400,000. The cost of cases that did not go to trial was $192,000. So, in fact, very few go to trial. As Barnes said, 3 to 5 a year go to trial. So even though they're twice as expensive, so if you average the two kinds together, you get $200,000. You separate the ones that didn't go to trial, $192,000. So just a small savings, but there are so many more of them. And then the few that went to trial ended up costing, on average, $400,000. So it doubles the cost if you go to trial. And as far as the incentive to plead guilty, I think that would have to depend on what the offer was. And the choice between a death sentence and life without the possibility of parole, I don't know. I think that's a very personal, individual decision. I think if there were a possibility of parole, then it depends on how old you are. If you're 60, maybe 30 years doesn't sound reasonable to be paroled. So I perhaps some of the defense attorneys might speak to that better than I, but...
Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you, Barnes. You wear many hats. Thank you for your work on the
commission.
You talked about a mitigation specialist, and I wonder if you could possibly explain what a mitigation specialist
sure.
does
in Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, mitigation specialist is a person who investigates the personal life of the defendant and who develops all of the psychiatric and other impacts that may have affected that individual. It's all aimed at the penalty phase of the case if it goes to trial. So it's a very specialized field of its own and requires a trained and quite competent person to do it.
Thank you.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation, and I have a question regarding the cost factors where you talked about that it's hard, you know, because of the range of the cases and your estimate about, you know, for the coming biennium. Can we look at Washington and make some sort of parallels here as far as cost savings, because you talked quite a bit about the difference in our how we handle these cases versus Washington. Has Washington seen cost savings that we may be able to get a better sense of cost savings here in Oregon, or is it too much comparing apples and oranges because it's a different system?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dingfelder, I believe that Jeff Ellis, who will be presenting later, has more specific information about the Washington savings. I'm sure that they did save money, but I think, again, it comes back to the results. It's not just the statutory changes in place in Washington, but actually what ended up happening. The decisions that were made and the actions that were taken resulted in the savings, not strictly the statutory changes. So I think maybe Jeff can talk about that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Barnes, one question for you, if I could. Just clarification, you were giving us numbers. I caught the number in Oregon, 36 current death row MH versus 8. Then you gave another number, which was for a time certain, 20 versus 3. Could you give me that time span?
Since 2000,
okay,
the number of death sentences imposed in Oregon versus Washington.
Great, thank you. Any other comments or questions for this panel? Thank you very much for coming forward and being here today. Our next panel is going to be Don Rees, Bob Herman, and Rick Wessenberg.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'll start off just by introductions. My name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County. To my right is Rick Wessenberg, who is the district attorney in Douglas County. And to my far right is Deputy District Attorney Don Rees from Multnomah County. And we hope this morning to try to briefly respond to all these bills and to the concepts, quite frankly, that these bills propose in general. I think maybe we'll start with Rick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. ladies and gentlemen of the committee, the first bill we're going to address is Senate Bill 366, and the primary and critical concern with Senate Bill 366 is the shift of cost to the counties associated with capital litigation. You just heard from Mr. Ellis the tremendous amounts of monies that are expended on capital litigation, and rightly so, from the standpoint of what you heard is that these cases require at least two litigators, at least a mitigation specialist, at least an investigator. It's been my experience that the teams tend to actually be larger than that still, all of which then incurs a tremendous cost. And that is a cost that that the counties, certainly the counties in Southern Oregon, simply are not in a position to bear at this juncture. And so that is our primary concern with Senate Bill 366. Likewise with Senate Bill 367, but also the 367 then also segues us into a different issue, which is the issue of the review panels vis-a-vis the appropriateness of the filing of the charges the decision to seek the death penalty in the initially. The concern with this is that what we have traditionally have had vested in the district attorney and the elected district attorney for each county is the ability to decide if a case is appropriate, if it's appropriate to go forward as an aggravated murder, and if it's appropriate to go forward to seek the death penalty. This bill then will create sort of a new layer that will become somewhat onerous in the prosecution of these cases, as well. Could this process in and of itself spur additional litigation? And so that's the primary concern with Senate Bill 367.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm Don Reese, Senior Deputy District Attorney from Multnomah County, and I'm here today to testify against, in particular, Senate Bill 368 and also 355. Currently, as you know, Oregon is one of the death penalty states that does not require a formal election by a district attorney to seek the death penalty in aggravated murder cases. The mechanism by which death penalty is put on the table, so to speak, is an indictment by the grand jury for certain types of criminal homicide, those deemed to be aggravated homicide by the legislature. The current system, as you know, has been found to be constitutional by the Oregon Supreme Court and by the United States Supreme Court. That is the result of many years of litigation in local courts, state courts, and federal courts of review, and we now have in Oregon a death penalty system that works legally and constitutionally and has been deemed to afford all of the necessary protections for the accused, and appropriately so. It is a system that is blind to race and socioeconomic status. It allows for the jury to determine whether death should be imposed or some lesser sentence, and it eliminates pressure from outside forces. When we look at other states that require a district attorney election to seek imposition of the death penalty, what we find is that, as you might imagine, it can become a political process. In New York, in one high-profile case where the Bronx DA declined to seek the death penalty, he found himself under attack by the governor, who believed the death penalty should be sought. In the state of Texas, there's a wide disparity, county by county, of when the death penalty is sought. Harris County, Houston, Texas, has the lion's share of death penalty cases. And the district attorney there, depending on which side of the fence people were on, either was seen as a champion of justice or a draconian district attorney who was seeking the death penalty in too many cases. Other counties in Texas rarely seek the death penalty. It's likely, If a notice requirement becomes part of Oregon law, then individual district attorneys will face pressure from various groups and constituents of whether they should bring the death penalty or not. In terms of cost, it's axiomatic that a change like this will trigger additional litigation. There will be challenges by the defense as to the nature of the notice, the quality of the notice, whether it was made in a timely fashion, whether the defendant understood notice had been given, and we can anticipate these issues will be litigated again both at the state level and federally. In the state of Maryland, which is a notice state, in Grandison v. State in 1995, after being convicted of multiple murders, the defendant raised the issue that he was not on notice the state would seek the death penalty on all of the murders. Now, ultimately, the state withstood that attack, but the court was very cautious and indicated that perhaps in the future they would find that adequate notice had not been given. The secondary requirement in Senate Bill 368 is notice by the district attorney of which evidence in particular the state would use in seeking to establish the factors that would lead to imposition of the death penalty, aggravating evidence. I would note that under current Oregon law, there is already a discovery requirement, and the state must disclose the evidence it seeks to introduce at trial, as well as the federal Brady requirement that requires prosecutors to present evidence which is exculpatory. Requiring the state to specify through a notice process of which evidence it intends to rely on during the death penalty process, again, is an invitation for the defense to then attack the quality of the notice, the timing of the notice, and to seek to exclude evidence under the argument that the defendant wasn't on notice that the state was going to rely on that evidence. And so the ultimate goal would be to block the introduction of the evidence. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. And Bob, did you want to go ahead and
please
wrap up this one?
Thank you, Chair Przanski. As you might guess, the District Attorney Association is in opposition to all these bills, and Don has done a good job in characterizing what I believe to be a flaw in each, and that is they all create, by their language, different provisions that will be challenged by the defense. There's not a decent litigator that I've ever been involved with that will not challenge anything and everything in an aggravated murder case. That adds up to money, that adds up to more post-conviction, that adds up to a great deal of time, money, and probably most importantly, an imbalance to the system of justice in terms of these types of cases. If I might just for a second, what these cases tend to do. We have a death penalty system in Oregon for aggravated murder. Everyone knows that. And these bills complicate that system. They provide obstructions to that system. And I think I don't know that it's the elephant in the room, but the bottom line is if you want to get rid of the death penalty, then that should be taken, I believe, to the citizens of Oregon. If that's not the purpose or the intent, and we're looking at costs and we're looking at the practical implications of this bill, then the question is, how does this affect the prosecutions and the justice system on aggravated murder cases? And as I mentioned, this involves additional costs. This involves additional barriers. The notice provisions Don's covered, panels involve all sorts of additional issues and changes to our structure and our system. One of the bills proposes that a defense attorney would be involved in the decision whether a case should be prosecuted or not. if I might, it bears repeating or bears mentioning that as we discuss intellectually and structurally a statute such as this, we must remember that in Oregon, if you intentionally kill another human being in the most brutal and vicious way, or you deliberate and plan for that killing years in advance and announce it publicly, you most likely will only be charged with a crime of murder with a minimum of 25 years. That's not aggravated murder. Many of the men and women in my position around the state have explained time and time again to families why this case isn't even eligible for the death penalty, why this case isn't eligible for life without parole, because intentionally killing another human being in Oregon is not aggravated murder. It becomes aggravated murder if there's an aggravating circumstance as defined by law. We deal and live with these cases yearly, sometimes monthly. That aggravating factor can be a number of things, but it can be the killing of multiple victims. It can be the killing of a child, the torture of an individual. There's a variety of ways that we see in our communities. The reality is that every one of these cases has a face. And so when we discuss the costs and when we discuss the particulars of these bills and why they're good, we must keep in mind the faces. And this kind of deals with the panels and someone else making decisions about whether this case should have been brought as a death penalty case, whether it should be brought at all in the beginning. There's no one that lives with these cases closer than the district attorneys that are involved in the prosecution. There is no way. Just taking a recent case I was involved in, a call at 6:30 on a Friday evening that there's a dead baby at a local hospital, unexplained circumstances, there may be a body in a home. As that case takes place over the course of that evening, gather police information, work on search warrants, find that there's a body in the home, realize that there's a dead baby, a pregnant woman has been murdered. That case evolves to the fact that now there's a police officer, because a call comes in that a pregnant woman is missing, and the police officer sits at that home, and we're telling him that you can't tell them anything because we haven't been able to identify this person yet. All the way through the weekend, the search of the crime scene, the search warrants, attending an autopsy of a 7-month-old child that was never took a breath, talking with family members, a fiance, father of an unborn child that was murdered, talking with a mother back east, a father back east in different locations, having someone from our victim's office call them every 2 weeks over the course of close to a year and a half to update them on what's going on. Those are all just snippets of closeness to a case that are uniquely vested in the district attorneys making decisions about how to proceed on those cases. And as far as the notice provision, and I understand the intent and the argument, I haven't yet met a defense attorney on a capital case that can tell me within 90 days, much less 6 months, the mitigating circumstances that I should take to the family or I should take to the community or that I could consider, should consider in determining whether this individual should be taken to trial for a jury of 12 citizens, decide to answer the questions that should decide whether they should receive the death penalty or a life sentence without parole or perhaps the possibility of parole. It simply is not realistic. It's not practical. And in fact, in terms of notice provisions, I can tell you specific cases where our position has moved when we found out that an inmate was involved in an assault plan in the jail or a plot to kill a witness. When we found out and actually talked to family members and found out his stepmother was raped, this was something that no one knew about until well into the development of our case. We see in our communities the damage that these cases create. We have to dispatch counselors to schools to talk to middle school students about why their 12-year-old schoolmate was murdered in a revenge killing, why the 15-year-old Westview High School student was murdered in a revenge killing. These are all real and practical considerations. Each case is different, and they involve a lot of emotions, a lot of work, and a lot of consideration. In our county, we have two attorneys on murder cases now, and I've heard time and time again, and the lady before me was correct, it's difficult to predict how each case will go, but I've heard time and time again from a defense attorney and from defendants who I've had the opportunity to speak to that life without parole is just as bad as a death sentence as far as they're concerned. In fact, one defendant recently stated that, "We know they'll never put me to death in Oregon, but I don't want to be on death row." Each case has a living story, and each case needs to be evaluated at the local level by the individuals involved. And when you put a dollar figure on it, and it's certainly worth the discussion and the public debate, but remember that eliminating the death penalty or making it so difficult and creating so many more barriers for a death penalty case to be prosecuted will not be saving a great deal of dollars because you still have a life without parole possibility. And I can guarantee you, from my prosecutor's perspective, if the worst that a person faces is life without parole, then why in the world would they not seek a trial? And why in the world wouldn't their attorneys be vigorously fighting to make sure that person doesn't spend the rest of their life in prison? It's quite frankly, it's common sense. And those of us that work in the field know that that's what we'll see. Thank you, and Chair, and we're all open for any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Senator Wissa.
Thank you. You mentioned that the defense attorney would be involved in the prosecution choices in one of the bills, I believe, and I missed that. Which bill is that?
As I read Senate Bill 367, there would be a death panel to review cases charged. And
Section 3, sub C.
Senator Whitsitt, and includes the defense attorney in that process.
Section 3, sub 2?
Section 3, sub C.
Thank you. Second question.
Yep.
Could you estimate the effects of shifting 50% of the cost to the counties on the DA's charging practices in many of the counties?
Senator Whitsitt and members of the committee, I don't know what the number is. I just know what the effect would be for counties that house institutions. In my county, we have Coffee Creek. Unfortunately, haven't had a homicide there, but in Marion County and Umatilla County and Malheur County, they would incur the cost of homicides within the institution. I'm not sure. I'm sure someone from the defense counsel could tell you what that specific cost would be. It's the bills charge, half of the defense cost. And suffice to say, county commissioners, I suspect, would not be pleased with the prospect that they had no control over the costs or ability to even deal with the costs.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, if I may answer your question, in addition to Mr. Herman's comments, it's our belief that shifting the cost to the district attorney, which would be the cost of defense, of course, because the prosecution costs are already borne by the district attorney's office, would result in a disparate treatment of individuals within the state of Oregon, in that a person might commit aggravated murder in one county and receive very different treatment than another individual who committed aggravated murder in another county. Now, we know that there are differences state by state, as we've heard this morning. That is a result, I believe, of the state's sovereign authority and that different states may seek the death penalty or any other criminal sanction in a different fashion than other states. But within the state, different treatment county by county seems to me to strike a fundamental unfairness. And if it's driven by economic factors, where perhaps one of the timber money counties simply would not, even in the worst types of murder cases, be able to afford to put on this kind of trial, it seems unfair to the people in that county, and it may also be unfair to criminal defendants who are treated differently county by county. So this effort seems to be simply a disincentive for district attorneys to seek the death penalty, but I believe it raises some issues related to fundamental fairness both to the accused and to members of the community.
Other questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was some discussion about the triggering additional litigation, particularly regarding the notice issues. And we heard about Washington, and I wonder if any of you on this panel or anyone else who's going to testify can discuss whether their system results in additional challenges, additional litigation based on, you said, I believe, the notice and the timing of the notice.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Bonamici, I can't cite you a particular case from Washington State, but as a practitioner, I know, and these gentlemen know, that whenever there is a requirement such as giving notice, that's always going to be fodder for a defense attack. In the area of sentencing notices that are now required when the state seeks an upward departure sentence, for example, we've seen these attacks of inadequate notice, untimely notice, the defendant did not understand there was notice, it wasn't filed, etc. And those begin at the trial court level, and then they just rise up through the appellate courts and post-conviction relief, and we'd anticipate, I think, as I said, as it's really an axiom, that these challenges will necessarily follow a notice requirement.
Other questions? Gentlemen, a couple of things I just want to clarify. regarding the cost factors, and Don, you made some reference. I know we have another panel that's going to come up that may be able to give some more about Washington State. But what I understand is that they currently have the obligation of where this counties would incur part of the cost. So it seems like we already have that potential factor, knowing that there's individual district attorneys for each of those counties making those decisions based on what they feel is just with the economics that they have. And I'm wondering if you think that we in Oregon would have some type of different results by having the cost for these type of cases being shared between the state and the county.
Well, Chair Brzezinski, again, I would just observe, I would anticipate that there would be disparities county by county based on economic resources.
Okay. So let me follow up with, I guess, the other part on this is that the currently we have 36 counties, 36 different decision makers for these type of cases. My understanding, not every county actually has capital or aggravated murder cases going forward. And is there a disparity because of how our current system allows for that discretion? Because nothing forces or requires either the two elected officials or yourself or Mr. Strunk to actually go forward and seek the the death penalty.
Chair Brzezinski, it's my understanding that most of the district attorneys in Oregon follow the practice that my boss, Michael Strunk, follows, which is to seek the death penalty in those cases where, pursuant to the aggravated murder statute, the death penalty is necessarily one of the three options available to the jury. I do understand that there are some district attorneys who do some sort of de facto election. I believe that is within their rights as the elected district attorney. Does that create a disparity? I guess arguably, some people might say that there is, but at least it's not being set up by the death penalty scheme itself, which I think this necessarily would. In terms of election, you know, when we talk about Washington State, we know that the King County prosecutor's decision not to seek the death penalty in the Green River Killer case was not only highly controversial, but put other prosecuting attorneys in the state of Washington in a position where it might ultimately be very difficult to justify a death penalty election, given that it's hard to imagine a crime worse than that committed by the Green River Killer.
All right, one last question for each of you. One of the, issues that we're looking at are, say, possible alternatives is removing life with the possibility of parole from these type of cases. Could you give me your perspective as to whether you think we, for a policy level, should be looking at removing, in capital murder cases, life with the possibility of parole?
Chair Przanski, so removing life, you had me nervous there for a minute, life with the possibility of parole. As I said, each of these cases, they come in, and basically all of a sudden as a prosecutor we have a circumstance, what happened, we've got a homicide, and we work through that, and then we work on who is it, what did they do, and who are they. Personally, I believe that there are cases of aggravated murder when all the information is in, that and you speak with family members and you assess the situation. I believe there are cases where it may be appropriate that if the defendant comes to us and says we're offering life with possibility of parole after so many years, that may be appropriate resolution of the case. It gives us in the community a third option, if you will, on an aggravated murder case, and we've seen cases, I think we've seen them across the state, where that decision is made. So to me, eliminating that is not probably consistent with the realities of the full assessment of these cases.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, as you know, as prosecutor, every case that comes before you, every case is unique, and every defendant that comes that you deal with is unique, and so and every situation is unique. And I concur with what Mr. Herman was saying, that while it's probably not often, there are going to be times when life 30 sentence could be an appropriate resolution for an aggravated murder case. And so if I could respond also to something that Senator Whitsitt was asking. You were asking about, I wanted to pick up on what the gentleman said, about the effect of transferring half of the cost to the counties. Aside from the issue of having disparate treatment around the state, you really could really financially cripple a county with that type of a burden. If a county, you know, it's not untoward in a small county, a small county like ours, that it, you know, to have, you know, sometimes we go for a period of time and we don't have an ag murder, and sometimes we get ag murder after ag murder, and so that financial burden on top of everything else could frankly be crippling, and that shouldn't be the financial decision. Shouldn't be what's weighing in on the decision to how to proceed on a criminal case. And so thank you, Senator, for giving me the opportunity.
If I could respond to that, I was thinking along of Curry County or Lake County, where an aggravated murder trial could cost, half of it could cost about half of the budget of the county for the entire year.
Precisely.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you, Senator.
Perspectives.
Thank you.
All right, my next panel is going to be Pat Ellers, Rich Wolf, and Jeff Ellis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Ellis. I am the director of the Oregon Capital Resource Center. I'm also a professor of law. I've taught previously at the University of Texas Law School, at Seattle University Law School, and most recently at Lewis and Clark Law School. And as that represents, I've also practiced death penalty defense in a variety of jurisdictions, including Texas, the federal courts, and for a good period of my career in Washington State. And what I'd like to do today is address some of those questions that have been asked about the differences between Washington and Oregon in terms of the death penalty system. I think we need to start with the proposition that lawyers and judges like rules, and that those rules, those statutes, sort of create realities and differences in the way death penalty systems are administered. Oregon, if you don't know, adopted its death penalty system from one of my former states, the state of Texas. Washington adopted it from Georgia. And there are differences in those systems. For instance, Washington requires proportionality review. Oregon and Texas don't. Washington has a requirement that includes the filing of a death penalty notice, one of the provisions we're talking about today, and Oregon does not. It seems to me that, first of all, the first thing that the death penalty notice does is reflect a reality that not every aggravated murder case is a death penalty case. And we know this to be true in both Washington and Oregon State because the vast, vast majority of aggravated murder cases do not result in death sentences. Approximately 92% in Oregon do not result in death sentences. And a slightly higher percentage in Washington State. What a notice bill does is give prosecutors discretion to say whether this particular aggravated murder is in fact a death penalty case. And so it creates, I think, both an expectation both within the legal community and the broader community that there is a second decision that must be made after an aggravated murder is filed. And what you see, for instance, in Washington State is prosecutors declaring at a very early stage in their cases that a case is either going to be a death penalty case or it is not. And when they declare that it's not a death penalty case, of course, all of those costs associated with the death penalty fall away. I prepared a number of charts for this hearing today, and perhaps the most interesting and chart, and one that I really did not expect when I began my work as resource counsel here in Oregon, is the chart that says, reflects the average number of days from case filing to resolution. And it has two lines on the graph, one in blue that reflects the amount of time to plea, and one in red that reflects the amount of time to trial. And essentially those two graphs are virtually the same. In other words, the amount of time to plea and the amount of time to trial in a death penalty case are very similar. If you charted that in Washington State, what you'd see is that the plea numbers were very small and the red line to trial were very large. In other words, those cases where death is sought take a long time to go to trial. But those cases where death is taken away are resolved at a much earlier date in the process, and therefore, all of those death penalty costs fall away at that early stage. And that's what's not happening here in Oregon. Essentially, the death penalty costs are used are incurred up until the time of resolution, which is not that much different than the time of trial. And then if you look at the death sentences imposed by county, and let's use Multnomah County as an example, death is imposed in about 2% of their cases. Yet we pay the death penalty cost in 100% of all of those cases, despite the reality that death is only imposed in 2%. So we have 98% of the cases that are treated as death penalty case where we pay the death penalty cost, but where death is not imposed. And it seems to me that's a huge burden on the citizens of the state of Oregon to pay death penalty money for cases that are not death penalty cases. Let me answer a couple of questions that were asked previously about the death penalty and the notice provision in Washington State. First of all, it is true to say that the plea bargain in the Gary Ridgway case, the Green River case, did result in some suppression of the number of death sentences sought for some period of time, but it wasn't dramatic. The Washington Supreme Court, which has to do proportionality review, evaluated Ridgway, essentially found that it stood outside of other cases and that death could again be sought in other cases that didn't involve victims as many as Ridgway. He killed 48 people, 49 now, based on a recent solved homicide. Has there been litigation in Washington State over the notice provision? Yes, there has. I actually was the lawyer involved in the litigation, so I know it well. In Washington State, the notice provision said that the notice needed to be filed in the court file and served on the defendant. And there was a case where a prosecutor filed it but didn't serve it on the defendant, and the Washington Supreme Court said that was insufficient because the statute said what the statute said. And they said in that opinion, the easiest way to serve this notice in every case going forward would simply be to stand in court and say, Mr. Defendant, I'm serving you with the death penalty notice, you're on notice. Every prosecutor does that now. There hasn't been any litigation at all since. So there was a problem, and it was identified by a lawyer, and it resulted in relief to that individual's client. But since that day, there hasn't been any litigation about it. I should say that we're willing to work with the committee in terms of any particular language. If there are concerns about the particular language in any of the statutes, but we believe that investing prosecutors with discretion can cause the death penalty cost to fall away for those cases which aren't death penalty case and save Oregonians a tremendous amount of money.
Thank you. Who would like to go next?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Pat Ehlers. I'm an assistant federal public defender working in Portland in the federal defender's office there. I've been working in capital litigation off and on for the past 17 years. I have no connection really to the state of Oregon with respect to my work other than that the Attorney General's office is my opposing counsel in my federal habeas litigation. Presently, I'm doing one capital habeas case in federal court. It's one of the two cases that have made it to federal court thus far. And as a result, I'm working very closely and have been litigating that case, the one case I'm working on, for the last 8 years. That litigation is still ongoing. I asked to be part of this panel today because based on my experience having worked in capital litigation in another state, Oklahoma, a much more active death penalty state, and based on my experiences there and my experience having sort of brought me here to Oregon for fighting the death penalty in federal court, I thought it would be useful to share my observations with you about how Oregon works, what doesn't work, and what seems to be costing an enormous amount of money in terms of litigation that maybe shouldn't be going on. One of the things I wanted to touch on, I'll touch on each of the bills individually, but I wanted to first start out mentioning one of the comments that Mr. Herman made in the previous panel. And you hear this from the prosecution bar in general. When you have unbridled discretion in your decision-making power, and you are an elected official, you do not want that discretion limited. That just makes common sense. The district attorneys of the state of Oregon, the 36 decision makers in these counties, do not want their discretion impeded in any way. For instance, if you look at the notice provision, it's a fairly benign provision. It simply says, make a decision about whether you're going to charge a death penalty case in the first 6 months from the time you charge the case. You already know that it's an aggravated murder case. You already have the evidence before you. You've got 6 months to make a decision. At that point, determine whether this will be a death penalty prosecution. Why is that important? As Jeff Ellis just mentioned, it limits the time, investigation cost, expenditure of resources in that first 180 days once that decision is made. If there is no death penalty being sought, at that point, you don't have the need or the requirement under the ABA guidelines to have two capital litigators. You don't have the requirement to have a mitigation specialist. You don't have the requirement at that point to have a bifurcated proceeding. I want to just mention, for those of you who are not familiar with capital litigation, think about this for a moment. When you're dealing with a death penalty trial, you're dealing with two separate trials. Senator Bonamici, you asked a question earlier about what a mitigation specialist is. Most of my work in the federal system is taking apart the second stage of a death penalty trial. It is, without question, very difficult to overturn a guilt conviction, the guilt-innocence determination, that first trial. It's a situation where in federal court and in the appellate system in Oregon, we spend most of our time looking at the mitigation phase, the sentencing phase. So we're trying to determine whether a jury fairly imposed the death penalty. There's lots of work to be done there. Those mitigation specialists at the trial level, they're putting that case together. But if you don't have a death penalty case, there's no need to have that second trial. And I will tell you, there's no need to have me in the process. I'm involved with the federal government. My budget is not in any way linked to the state of Oregon. And as I mentioned, I've been litigating this last one case for the last 8 years, and I only rely on federal resources for that litigation. And my incentive in that case is to simply do the very best for my client. Short footnote, just to give you an example in terms of the resource disparity that's available between Oregon and the federal government. When I first got the case that I'm working on right now, I noticed that all of the victim's family members were in Germany, and that it seemed to me, from looking at the record, even from an early stage, that this family was not supportive of the imposition of the death penalty in the case. And I knew from my prior work in Oklahoma that I should talk to the victim's family and discuss with them personally, from my own perspective, whether or not they were interested in seeing this litigation go forward. I asked my office for resources. I got a specialist in language, and who was also a German lawyer, to fly with me to Germany. I spent 10 days on the ground in Germany meeting with all the victims' family members. I talked to every one of them except the parents of one of the girls who talked to us on the phone but not in person. And to a person, they were all in agreement that the case should settle for life without the possibility of parole. Now, one of the bills that you have before you talks about these post-trial settlement panels. I'm just going to jump to that for a minute to give you an example of what could be achieved in a bill like that. If you have a panel that is concentrating on whether settlement is appropriate at every stage after the sentence has been imposed, you are going to ultimately limit your litigation costs, you will save money, and you will end the litigation sooner, and importantly, you will give the victims' families, in many instances, the closure that they want. In talking to the victims' family members in the case that I'm working on right now, the one thing that I had not realized was how difficult it is for these cases to be litigated over decades. They get notices from the Attorney General's office. They get notices about the litigation and what its status is. They're updated. And any time that they go to the mailbox and get a letter about the status of the ongoing litigation, they are re-victimized. They are having to deal with this anew. That is not something that they should have to go through in instances where they are supportive of settlement. The bill that you have before you that would allow for settlement, I think, would encourage that. Thus far, we've not been able to get to a point where the case I'm working on has settled. However, given that fact, the state of Oregon is continuing to litigate against me, and we will continue to do so until the case is resolved. I want to go back to the idea of discretion. I just talked to you about my experience dealing with victims, and Mr. Herman was talking about his experience dealing with victims' families. And if you heard the emotion in his voice when he was talking, it's totally understandable. It's completely understandable why a district attorney would feel they needed to file a death penalty in a particular case. If they're in the community, if they're elected officials, and if the community is bearing down upon them to make a decision, they are not going to be necessarily as neutral and detached as you would be if you are making the decision as a panel. I mean, think for a moment what the panel that's discussed in one of your bills today is talking about. It's a panel of retired judges, prosecutors, possibly a defense counsel, sitting back outside of the emotion of the case and trying to make a determination about whether a death penalty should be imposed. Where do we see that most often used? We see it in the federal system. Department of Justice has a main justice unit that deals just with death penalty cases. They review whether or not a death penalty should be imposed. They discuss it amongst themselves. Defense counsel make a presentation. And then it's determined at that conference whether or not they will have a death penalty or not. That's a neutral and detached process. Where else do we see that in the criminal justice system? We see it in terms of simple things like just a search in a criminal case, right? In a search in a criminal case, the police officer knows that the person that they're looking at maybe has evidence of a crime in their house. The police officer doesn't get to just jump into the person's house and start searching the house. You have to have a neutral and detached magistrate. The police officer may have an emotional connection to the defendant. He's thinking they've done something wrong. He wants to go get the evidence. But a neutral and detached judge sits back and says, well, wait, let me look at all the facts you have and determine whether there's probable cause. If it looks like you've got probable cause, you can go forward with your search. In a death penalty context, having a panel review cases to determine whether a death penalty should be filed will ultimately save you money in the state of Oregon. There's no question about that, because you will have fewer cases determined to be death penalty cases, and as a result, you won't have the added cost of a mitigation specialist, two lawyers, and the decades worth of litigation. If you're not familiar in terms of the litigation, under a federal statute, you're entitled to counsel from my office if you have a death penalty case. Otherwise, you do not. Just as an example, in many instances where people are sentenced to less than death, life without parole, for instance, they may be appointed counsel from my office. I have, in numerous occasions when they have avoided death penalty at trial, convinced the client to dismiss the case in their own best interest because they could ultimately face a death penalty. So now you've got a lawyer telling the client, you are not going to benefit by further litigation. You should get rid of the case because you've already achieved the best result. And in many instances, that's life without the possibility of parole. So the other thing I wanted to touch on was the argument that the death penalty in Oregon, unlike other states, is not a political decision. I think that's a mistaken impression, and I don't think you should have that impression. Any time a district attorney must be elected to office and exercise discretion, they're going to be politically pressured in many instances to pursue a death penalty when otherwise they might not. And again, having things like a notice provision, having things like an opportunity for a review panel to take a look at a case, and then most importantly, financial accountability, financial responsibility for the decision to seek death. That's a critical component in two of the bills. Now, I read, I think it's 366. Let me just catch up for a second here, because I wanted to point out something to you. When I looked at 366 and 367, I thought that they were pretty similar. Both of the summaries read almost identically, And they talk about, in 366, a 50-50 split. And the summary to 367 also has a 50-50 split in the summary. But the text of the bill seems to be a complete cost sharing of the entire cost. So I think the summary on 367 is incorrectly drafted. So you should just make note of that. But in any event, looking at both 366 and 367, what it really does at its core, you could take both of these bills and, I suppose, take the best parts out of each one of them. But what it does, most importantly, is say to a district attorney in an individual county, if you're thinking about selecting a death penalty, also think about the cost of that litigation. Have some accountability for the cost of that litigation. I was just, in preparation for this panel discussion, listening to a debate that was going on in Connecticut. And in Connecticut, they're thinking about completely abolishing the death penalty, as New Jersey, New Mexico, and now Illinois have recently done. And in Connecticut, as they were discussing it, one of the public defenders that was being interviewed in the story said that in Connecticut, they have an open spigot of tax dollars just flowing out all the time on capital punishment, and they need to figure out a way to limit that spigot, to turn it off possibly, but at least to turn it down. Now, I want to talk about that for just a second, turning it down. It can't be just cutting defense costs, because I will tell you, as a capital litigator in federal court, if you cut defense costs, you are helping my litigation. Without question. Right now, Oregon is funded at about $11.7 million per year. If they need additional costs for the defense, that's all the defense, from trial through post-conviction. If you wind up cutting that cost, you will create further litigation. There's a place where you will create further litigation. That's ineffective assistance of counsel. That's failure to investigate, prepare, and present mitigation evidence. That's the Sixth Amendment, and that's where I make my mark as a capital litigator, taking cases apart where defense wasn't adequately funded. So it's not just that. When I looked at all of these provisions, you know, I'm not an advocate. I'm outside your system, so I'm just looking at these bills. Do they save money? It seemed to me they did. That's why I gave you each a written summary of my testimony so you can look at. And in each instance, I concluded that in reviewing this, I couldn't see where you actually increased your costs. I think there's only one provision where there's even a cost increase discussed. It's very minimal, and it has to do with funding a panel for settlement judges, because you have to have the settlement judges somewhat funded. But in any event, I didn't see in any instance where there would be increased cost. And as Jeff mentioned, I don't see an instance where you're going to have litigation, for instance, over a notice provision. Something like that would be a small matter that you could ultimately resolve pretty quickly if it came up. So I think right now, the last thing I want to conclude with is just that the biggest part about limiting the death penalty is that oftentimes we hear, if you change it, if you change the system in any way, you'll just create more cost. And that's really not the case with any of these provisions. I haven't seen one where I see any real value in litigating these. I would, as a defense attorney, want to have a settlement panel. I think that would be very useful. I think that would encourage settlement of cases. And I guess one of the other questions you should ask yourselves is, why do more cases not settle? One of the things you're doing is you're having a person make a decision about settlement that is fairly impaired. It's the criminal defendant. The defendant in the case oftentimes decides whether or not they're going to settle. So that's at the trial stage where they think all their options are still open. As you go further in the appeals process, I've noticed over time the clients ultimately decide they would be agreeable to settlement at a place where they previously weren't, and it's oftentimes off the table at that point. So this would afford and encourage the opportunity to have those kind of settlements take place, and the cost savings and the litigation costs being limited would be a benefit as well. I don't have any further comments unless you have any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, my name is Richard Wolf. I've been practicing law here in Oregon for 24 years. Justice Gillette called me in 1994 to appoint me to my first capital case. Incidentally, that case did not resolve until last year. I've argued cases before the, I've tried cases at the trial level, and I've argued them, capital cases, before the Oregon Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit, and the U.S. Supreme Court. And I wanted to talk to you about the fact that in these cases, you don't always get what you pay for, certainly in Oregon. And I want to emphasize what Mr. Ehlers has said about these costs are driven by decisions of the United States Supreme Court, which have said that death is different. And it is treated differently because of the irrevocable nature of the punishment. Consequently, these standards of the ABA guidelines, which mandate to counsel, which mandate a mitigation specialist, mental health and experts, are required by the United States Supreme Court. If you do not compose a team like that and you handle one of these cases, when the case ends up in Mr. Ehlers' office, it's going to get reversed and it's going to come back and these costs are going to mount. So I want to emphasize that these defense costs are an essential part of doing business if you want to have the death penalty in Oregon. Now, with respect to the provisions of notice, I would agree that to the extent if you're not going to get rid of the death penalty, then to the extent that you can limit these cases being handled as a capital case earlier in the process is going to cut costs. Again, the notice provision is one that, while it certainly is going to limit, it appears to the prosecutors that it is going to limit their discretion, the reality is they ultimately have the discretion to resolve these cases as less than death penalty cases in any event. And as we see from some of the charts, these cases end up getting resolved as less than death penalty cases. It's just that it happens way down the road. I can, speaking from my experience, the last case that I had in Multnomah County resolved after a week of jury selection to life with the possibility of parole. The case I handled before that in Multnomah County resolved about a month before jury selection. And I've had other cases which have resolved once we're right up to the eve, literally the eve of trial. So to the extent that this bill, the notice bill, will make prosecutors look at these cases more closely and decide if that's a resolution that they can live with earlier, it's going to save money. Now, I think, Senator Whitsitt, you asked what is going to make someone resolve a case if death is not a potential option. My experience has been that many defendants don't believe they're going to get a death sentence. And the threat of death is not really the real hammer in this case. The real hammer is life without the possibility of parole. And so someone asked about, I believe it was you, Chair Przanski, about the keeping or getting rid of the possibility of parole sentence. And I would agree with Mr. Herman that that is an important consideration in resolving some of these cases. And that is the motivation to seeking a resolution short of trial in many of these cases. So I would urge the committee to keep that as a potential option. If the state doesn't want to offer that, they don't need to offer it, and the case can go forward as a death penalty or as a life without parole case. So I think we are going to end up with more trials if we don't have that as a potential settlement resolution. And again, I agree with Mr. Ehlers that there's no harm in having a post-trial settlement panel that looks at these cases. I can tell you I have two cases in which the homicides occurred the year I passed the bar, which was 1987, and they are still proceeding at the state court level. And so to the extent that there is an external panel which is going to look at the case and try and bring resolution to it, that can only be a good thing in a cost savings matter, especially if you're using senior judges who have 50-some days of obligation to as part of their retirement anyway. So I would be in favor of that most definitely. The last point is that the cost savings, the cost shifting bill, it's certainly one that I think is of concern to smaller counties, but the reality is that these cases cost a lot of money, and they cost the state a lot of money. And to the extent that these decisions are tied to the reality of the costs of this litigation, I think it will foster closer and more scrutinized decision making, and I think that that's a good thing when we're talking about death penalty litigation. Thank you, unless there's any questions.
All right. Thank you. Did you have one other thing?
I did have one brief comment, Senator Przanski. With respect to this settlement panel issue, just to give you an idea, I ran some quick numbers on Oregon's death row. We've got 36 people on death row right now, and I took today's date, and then I ran out the numbers till each death row inmate reaches the age of 80. So I don't think any of the death row inmates that we have right now are going to reach the age of 80, but I wanted to give it a long age to see where we would be. If we had each of them live out their lives in prison without any further litigation, the cost of that incarceration, and I'm using DOC's numbers of $84.46 per inmate per day, and I calculated how many days left each of them have until they reach their 80th birthday, the cost was $36,978,699.50. So you heard at the very beginning of the talk that we've got $24 million in the biennium that we're going to spend on defense costs with respect to litigation. So if we had settlement panels that could settle cases to life without the possibility of parole, we would spend just slightly more than what we would spend in one biennium for just the litigation costs. And now, if you look at that, that's an enormous cost savings. And what I wanted to just finish with is that that's what we've got right now in Oregon. We've not executed anybody in Oregon against their will in 49 years. We've only had two executions involving volunteers, and so the death penalty in Oregon is a system of de facto life without parole. And we're spending so much more money than we otherwise would have to by litigating the death penalty portion of these cases.
All right. I'll open up for questions. Senator Bonamici first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do any of you on the panel know if other states have a similar 180-day notice time frame as is proposed in 368? Has that been problematic? That period of time been problematic? And the second part is, what's to stop if the district attorney has not made a determination? Is there anything that stops them from issuing the notice? And then, do they have to continue to seek the death penalty, or can they change that after the notice is issued?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can address that. Washington has a provision that says the notice should be filed within 60 days, or excuse me, 30 days by statute, although it can be extended. And oftentimes in those cases, the prosecutors and the defense attorneys agree on a certain period of time. But what I hear from my friends who are prosecutors in Washington State is the exact opposite I hear here. Here prosecutors say, we can't get this done in 180 days. And in Washington State, prosecutors say it needs to be done in 180 days, sometimes even less. They want to put a cap on the amount of time that defense attorneys take because they realize the costs are associated with that. In Washington state, and according to this bill, certainly there could be a situation, first of all, where death was sought, in other words, a notice was filed, and then it was withdrawn and taken back because of new circumstances. And in fact, Washington State has a provision in their bill where they can choose not to seek death, but then if new circumstances arise, like a serious prison assault by the defendant, the prosecutors can then file death if they can show that there's new information.
And my reading also was that there's nothing to prevent the case from resolving to a sentence of less than death if after the notice is filed, if the parties develop information that makes it appropriate to resolve the case through normal plea negotiations.
And if I could just briefly add to that, what we see in Washington State are sort of three variations. Number one, cases where the prosecutors say very, very early in the process, sometimes at the time of arraignment, I'm not seeking death. In other words, they've determined this is not going to be a death penalty case. I'm not going to spend death penalty money. I'm not going to give two defense attorneys and a mitigation specialist to the other side. So right out of the gate, they say it's not a death case. In some cases, the opposite things happen. A prosecutor says at the very beginning, I don't care what the defense is going to present. This is a death penalty case. Snohomish County Prosecutor Mark Rowe recently did that in a case that involved an individual serving a life without parole sentence as a three-striker who killed a prison official, strangled her in the chapel. And he said at the arraignment, I've read his records for the last 30 years. I know this is going to be a death penalty case. Here is the notice. He filed it on the defendant at the time of arraignment. So that's a case where death penalty money is going to be spent, but there was no reason to engage in that early process. And then the vast majority of cases sort of fit into the middle, where the prosecutor wants to make a determination based on the investigation conducted on his behalf and the investigation that is conducted by the defense, where they invite the defense in the process to decide whether this is going to be a death penalty case or not.
All right. Bill first and then Senator Wissett.
Mr. Ellis, two questions. In Washington, what are the options when you're charged with aggravated murder as it relates to penalty? Then the second question would be, in New Jersey just recently did away with the death penalty. Has that resulted in an increase in the number of trials?
In Washington, there are two options, the death penalty or life without parole. Obviously, there are two ways to plea bargain. You can plea bargain over sentence or you can plea bargain over charge. And so what happens sometimes in Washington State where prosecutors don't view it as a life without parole case, they plea bargain it down to a lower charge. In New Jersey, I think the sort of best indicator of New Jersey, which abolished the death penalty, is the murder rate in Newark, the most populous city, which went down after the death penalty was abolished in that state.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Ehlers, in your computations, you appear to make a couple of assumptions that the cost of incarceration for a death row inmate is average, and that the cost of incarceration for the average individual will not increase over the years. I think both of those are incorrect assumptions. Did you adjust your computations to affect the increased cost for future years in these inmates?
No, I did not, and you're correct that this estimate doesn't give you inflation over time for the time that they reach their 80th birthday. The most important takeaway, Senator Wittsett, on this would be that if you limited the litigation and you settled these cases, you're no longer litigating them. For instance, Mary Williams, who may speak later, is going to, I think, tell you that they estimated for just their litigation of the death penalty cases, they have a total of 5,700 hours. For the two cases in federal court that are currently pending, of that 5,700 hours, they've budgeted 2,850 hours to litigate against myself and one of the other lawyers from my office in simply two federal habeas cases. You have in the state of Oregon, I believe, somewhere around 28 death penalty cases that are pending in post-conviction. That's a bottleneck of cases that are heading to my office. Ultimately, what will happen is that unit in my office will expand. In Oklahoma, for instance...
Yeah, you answered the question.
Okay, and I just wanted to finish, Senator, just to point out that in Oklahoma, we had seven capital cases of any one attorney was doing seven capital cases. We had a special unit that did 30 capital cases a year. And the federal government was willing to pay for that to litigate against the state of Oklahoma. That will ultimately happen here in Oregon. It's just a matter of time. When the cases reach our office, we'll expand the resources to litigate the cases.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I've got one other panel that I need to get up here before we close for the day. And I'll call Tom O'Connor and Mary Williams. And just to give you a heads up, we have about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to need you to please keep your comments, succinct. And if written testimony or anything, you can hand that in as well. Tom, why don't you go first?
Okay, my name is Tom O'Connor. I'm here as a board member of the Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, and I've worked in corrections for about 22 years, 11 years I've spent in the Department of Corrections, nine of those as the head chaplain and two in the research unit. I now have a company called Transforming Corrections. I'm working in the field as an Oregon company. So I've worked with people on death row, and I've worked with a lot of people who are violent in prison. My whole work is around preventing violence and preventing victimization, so we want a system that works. So I'm well aware of the dangers of violence, and what we're trying to do here ultimately is to protect and stop violence from happening. There is a story that took place in 1976 in Bangladesh, and I was a young economics professor, was teaching economics in the university, and was trying to work in economics, loved this topic, and loved the students. However, as he was driving to the university, he saw a lot of people dying on the street because there was a famine that year in Bangladesh. As he kept driving to the university, people were still dying, so he began to question his economic system. My goodness, our big economic system is not working. It's not lifting these people out of poverty. So he took his students out into the community, and he found out what was happening, and the people in the community were able to support themselves, were able to live. They just couldn't get the resources that they needed. So he reached into his own pocket, and he took out the equivalent of $27, and he gave $27 to 42 women who bought furniture-making material and created a little business for themselves, lifted themselves out of poverty, paid back the money. That man was Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago, and now millions and millions of people are getting these small microloans to lift themselves out of poverty. My question is, what if we had a $27 solution to preventing violence and to lifting people out of crime? It's my contention that if you look at Muhammad Yunus, there's three things about his story. First of all, it was cheaper. Second, it was more effective than the current system. And third of all, it was more compassionate. I think you have put some options before yourselves that meet all three criteria. I think it's obviously cheaper. We've heard about that. It's more compassionate to some of the victims who want to end this endless cycle of notices in the mail. It's probably more compassionate, too, to the people of Oregon because it gives many more options. And I would contend it's more effective in preventing violence. The literature is pretty clear in terms of violence prevention. Does the death penalty prevent violence or not? Well, it's hard to say. Some studies say maybe a little bit. Some studies say maybe not at all. So, I mean, it's really out there. It's not really resolved. But there's a huge body of literature says, does violence actually cause violence? And there's a huge body of literature that says, yes, it does. So what we've got here is a system of state violence really trying to stop violence. We want to stop violence. That's what we all want to do. Now, are we stopping violence by having state violence? The evidence suggests that we're not. In some of the, we just heard the death penalty went down in New Jersey. If we treat a child with violence and we try and force them to stop certain behaviors, we know the literature is clear that those kids become more violent, not less violent. We know this in our school. Okay, I'm finishing up. So with that in mind, I would contend that you've got an option here. It's more compassionate, it's cheaper, and ultimately I think it's more effective. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm Mary Williams, Deputy Attorney General and Solicitor General. I'll talk as quickly as I can to make a few points here. The Attorney General's office handles these cases often at trial in smaller counties where they may not have the expertise and the resources. We are there as the prosecuting attorneys or working with the prosecutor. We're also providing investigatory assistance in preparing these cases. From that point on, our office represents the state in all of the appeals and collateral challenges. So we see all of these cases coming through the system. We also see the non-capital cases. And much of the discussion about cost savings has focused on trial. And yet a significant part of the cost of these cases is once the trial is complete and the cases then move into the appeals and the collateral challenges. And so I worry about that focus and some of what you've heard in terms of cost savings by looking at this. We've attempted to try to have cost comparisons. It is a very complex problem to try to resolve because there are cost savings by having the death penalty. And it's difficult to get a handle on how much you save, but it's not simply at trial. We know of many cases where because there was a plea deal at trial that avoided the death penalty, those subsequent appeals and collateral challenges were either waived entirely, meaning a significant savings of cost, or they were greatly reduced in terms of the kinds of issues that could be raised and what the costs actually were. And so it's important to take a look at this in terms of the entire cost to the system and not simply focusing on the trial cost. I also want to just briefly point out that our costs have gone down in these cases as we've worked more cases through the system. And it's true that we had a large backlog of cases in the post-conviction trial phase. We are now working to move those cases along. If you take a look simply at the direct appeal stage, when we had first had capital cases on direct appeal, they took an average of 1,800 hours to resolve. Because we've resolved many of the issues that recur in those cases, we've now brought that average time down to well under 700 hours, and in some of the cases, under 200 hours, so that the cases start to look much like the non-capital cases. We're experiencing the same thing in the other levels of review, post-conviction federal habeas. So, yes, while the costs are going to be great for the first federal habeas cases, that cost will go down as we resolve these issues in the courts and gain more experience over time as more of the cases move through the system. And then finally, let me just briefly say, some of these provisions would suggest adding new layers of review, new layers of process. I'm not aware of any bias in the charging decisions under the current system. And we do see the cases, as I've said, that are both the capital cases and the non-capital cases. And so adding those, I'm not sure what you get as a result. And finally, just on Senate Bill 369 that has the death penalty review panel, there will be costs associated with having that. And I wanted to point out that part of what we do in our office, which is different than Washington State, the district attorneys continue to represent the state as the cases move forward on appeal and with the collateral challenges for not only the capital cases but all of their criminal cases. So you want to be careful comparing the two states. Because those cases come to our office, though, and we are able to have a second look at what happened, sometimes we decide that it is appropriate to consider settlement. We've settled two capital cases in the past year because, in part of changes that the U.S. Supreme Court had changes in the law, but also because in our review we were able to say it's the appropriate thing to happen in these cases. And we worked with the victims, we worked with the district attorneys, to make sure that that settlement met everyone's needs, but that is part of what we currently have. And so I'm not sure that creating another process and another review panel really gets you what you may anticipate in that bill. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much. That's all I had signed up on the witness registration. We have a couple of minutes left, so I will just ask just before I close, was there anyone who wanted to give testimony on any of the bills that we've heard today on the death penalty, Senate Bill 355 as it would be amended, 365, 366, 367, 368, 369, 370? That's Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon County, speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 366. I want to just focus on a couple of differences quickly between Oregon and Washington, other than the information that you've heard already this morning. First of all, the state of Oregon is more than 50% owned by the federal government. The federal government doesn't like to be taxed by states, and so therefore we're prohibited from imposing property taxes on federal land. That land is not evenly distributed along the state. Senator Whitsitt has pointed out what would happen in a criminal case involving aggravated murder in a county like Curry or Lake, and I think that's very true. Another factor that's different between us and Washington State that relates to that is that the secure rural schools, when it was first reauthorized, there were about 31 states that would have shared in some of the federal revenues that came to the states in lieu of federal taxes. Oregon would have received 70% of those funds.
You got 30 seconds.
Okay, last point. We've got Measure 5, we've got Measure 50. Measure 5, Measure 50. That's not something that exists in the state of Washington. What I'm saying, in essence, is that there would be huge disparities from one county to the next in prosecutions of these cases, depending upon the financial condition of the county. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're adjourned for the day. We'll be back tomorrow at 8:30.